everybody. Welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and I write for cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write for thestopbutton.com.
And this is where we talk about one good movie and one bad movie. We do 30 minutes on each, and sometimes it runs a little over. Today, our good movie is Hour of the Wolf by Ingmar Bergman, and our bad movie is Caligula by Tinto Brass and Bob Guccione, to a large degree. We're going to start with Hour of the Wolf. You know, just from the title and the kind of descriptions that I've read of this movie over the years, I was expecting something like maybe Polanski's Repulsion or Barton Fink, almost the type of movie that's an actor sort of going crazy in a confined space. And with a title, I thought, like, well, I bet, you know, the scary stuff is going to happen at the, you know, titular Hour of the Wolf, which is between 4 and 5 a.m., I believe, but I don't think they ever mention it in
the
movie.
No, they never specifically say when the Hour of the Wolf is.
Yeah, but it's 4 to 5 a.m., and that's not what the movie is like at all. In fact, it sort of barely qualifies as a horror movie, even though it's creepy. Stephen King included it on his 100 best horror movies of the last 20 years or whatever list that he included in Danse Macabre, his book about the horror genre. And that was in like 82, I think. So I was looking forward to it, but, you know, I'm not really an Ingmar Bergman fan. But that's only based on The Seventh Seal, I should forewarn. Anyways, this one didn't really hook me either. It was a little dull sometimes. And there were some good, like, shock moments, but I was hoping for a lot of them. And there are a couple that are well done, but, you know, mostly I think it's not, you know, from what I know of Bergman's style, it's not too, this is what I mean by barely a horror movie. It's, you know, basically about this relationship deteriorating between this troubled artist and his girlfriend on this island where they're staying, and the creepy kind of, I don't know, carnival of souls, kind of ghouls who appear human and behave mysteriously start showing up, the other people who live on this island, and they're taking the artist into their fold. The artist is played by Max von Sydow, and it was all right. how did you feel about it?
Oh, I mean, I haven't seen The Seventh Seal, so every Bergman I've seen, I've loved, and this one I liked particularly because, well, it felt like Bergman doing a Fellini in some ways, just because of the weird cast, and then also I appreciate how it. I mean, it's almost like the Blair Witch Project at the beginning, which I thought was, very strange for what I was expecting, and then. You know, it's a person going crazy movie. I mean, it's hard to call it a horror movie because you don't ever find, it's never clear whether or not it's a ghost story or not, or it's just a movie about people going nuts. Mm-hmm. And taking it like that, I sort of really appreciated how just, so, I mean, okay, we're going to have to, what's our new motto? Always spoiling or something?
Yeah, we need to add something to the WordPress site that says,
yeah, we're going to spoil this movie for you.
permanent spoiler warning on all films.
There's this scene in the movie where this ghost shows up and seemingly forgets to pretend not to be a ghost to Liv Ullmann, who's the girlfriend who can see these ghosts, which are, when they're initially described, I never thought we were going to get to see them. When they're looking at the pieces of paper, sketches of them, I never thought you'd get to see them. And so when the Birdman came in at the end to peck at him, that was kind of interesting how Bergman did that. But
he intercuts a bird.
He intercuts a real bird. And the difference is that just, I don't know, 15 minutes before, he had a woman literally rip her own face off and take her eyeballs out. So it's very strange what he does and doesn't show, I guess would be the thing. And then, so this ghost warns Liv Ullmann, but also tells her she ought to read
his diary,
which is strange because it almost makes that ghost seem sympathetic. And then the diary goes back a couple days and reveals that he apparently is having an affair on the beach, which is awkward because he doesn't seem to be aware of it, which is where the whole he's insane thing comes in. And it's just creepy, I thought, was sort of the...
overall it's just creepy and unnerving, but I feel like Bergman movies are kind of creepy and unnerving even when they don't have ghosts in them because of how he directs people. He has a kind of trademark shot of an actor in close-up in the foreground and a person that they're talking to is in the background and they're facing in different directions. The guy in the foreground is facing towards the camera. That's in this movie, but it's so stylish that... I guess you could say, like, you know, there's stylish moments in this movie that are very creepy that have sort of been imitated by horror movies over the years, like Jacob's Ladder, and stuff that would, you know, than any horror movie would be proud to have in it, like, you know, certain effects, like the guy who appears to be walking on the wall after he's walking away from Johan, and sometimes it's sort of like the camera technique is the only really scary thing, like, because it jars you. And, you know, the sequence where he, you know, kills that kid on the beach and the way the camera suddenly becomes shaky after having been so, you know, in Bergman style, so ostentatious and panoramic of this beautiful island where this painter is living. And that's it's a really intimate, you know, and by intimate in a sinister way, scene between Johan and that boy, because it's completely silent and they go from kind of being aware of each other's presence or ignoring each other to being aware of each other's and then murdering, you know, fighting each other, and then he bludgeons this kid to death.
And what's so, I think, putting it at the end is when I say that it's not really a ghost story, because he's driven mad by his guilt, basically. And it's kind of like, and his girlfriend, Liv Ullmann, sort of presented as not being, not as bright as... I guess she could be, so it's...
She has kind of a wide-eyed naivete.
So, you know, she sort of, when she she ends the movie, kind of creepily wondering if she's seeing the ghost because she lived with him for so long, but it's just kind of like, maybe it just sort of not, you know, kind of insanity passed over to her from him. But, that scene where he kills the kid is just... really, that might be the best child murder scene I can think of.
Oh, please, Toxic Avenger. Hello.
Oh, okay. Just because you never presented with him being capable of that, and then all of a sudden it's revealed that, you know, he killed this kid, just cruelly murders this kid, and all I can think is, where's the parent of the kid? And then...
Well, I sort of took the kid to be another ghost because there were no consequences, and it's just something that, you know, like the other stuff she found written in his diary, so who can say?
I'm trying to think, there is another movie kind of like this, Haunted. What was it? Lewis Gilbert, 95, Aidan Quinn, and Kate Beckinsale. Where the ghosts are, it's hard to discern when something's real and when it's not. And it's ghosts just messing with people, really. And
right.
If you want to take this as a ghost story, that would probably be the most logical way to take it, because if you were to sit down and try and break out where, you know, the logic of ghosts in this movie, it would probably be impossible, because it's
every character in this movie is so crazy that, you know, the simplest explanation is that they're all ghosts. Every single one of them, every single person they've encountered on the island.
Yeah, well, it kind of has to be, because That's kind of the problem. Is it's you know, when you try
it's a problem that there's no grounding in reality, because horror movies have to, you know, establish some kind of reality that the horror has intruded on. But things are so weird right from the very start that they only get you know, so much weirder from how bleak they already are.
I'm trying to remember. Doesn't it start out with the filmmaker saying that the movie is about this artist who disappeared?
Yeah, it's, you know, that's the other part of the quasi Blair Witch thing, is that it opens with text saying, you know, the story you are about to see is true, and then it's bookended by the whole movie being told as a story to us by Liv Ullmann, even though she... Oh, wait a minute. She knows what was happening to her boyfriend even when she wasn't there. I guess they do know the same things as a couple.
Yeah, that was...
It's not a Lorraine Gary and Jaws 4 type of problem. It has a purpose within the plot. It's not a fake.
Jaws 4 references. Where else would people get that? But yeah, and so there, it's very real. I guess is realistic the word I'm looking for. It's very pseudo documentary at the beginning. They're setting up the camera. We hear them setting up the camera. We hear them filming her. And where this doesn't work is that, you know, she's presented as being herself in the opening scene, except then we're presumably watching a dramatization of these events. Yet she's played by the same person. And I know that's just being nitpicky, but it just doesn't... It breaks the pseudo-reality thing they were going for. And, I mean, to be fair, it's not like that was a big genre back then.
You think it would be more realistic if she'd been played by a different actress in the bulk of the movie that's bookended?
I just feel that the bookends prove problematic given how involved she is. Because from the title, I sort of, and the way we talked about it, I sort of assumed that it was going to be him going nuts by himself. Yeah. And even the way it describes how he's alone on, he goes missing. Well, he goes missing for, when he's outside of the girlfriend's presence, he's missing for only a few minutes. So, what, 15 minutes, basically, his entire psychosis is... broken out into. And it really reminds of Twin Peaks. I mean, this is obviously something that David Lynch saw with the walking on the walls and sort of the whole thing. But
Yeah, I could see that.
I'd never heard of it, actually.
Actually, more so than Twin Peaks, when the scene where the old woman who claims to be 147, right, is giving her creepy warning to... Well, actually, that type of creepy warning from spirits was in Twin Peaks, but it also reminded me of Inland Empire, the opening scene with Laura Dern being warned by a creepy old Ukrainian woman that she should look into some stuff. But actually, the looking into some stuff thing is, yeah, now I get the Twin Peaks thing. I don't know if that's what you were thinking of specifically.
No, it wasn't. I was thinking about the walking on the wall and the, I don't know what the other thing I was thinking of was. Trying to think of what else. Yeah, I mean, Bergman's kind of influential in the way that everybody saw him, and so it filters in, but I think Woody Allen's about the only guy who does Bergman homage.
and Bergman parody.
Yeah, and nobody else really... Because, I mean, Bergman was... Is Bergman still alive?
Let me see.
I mean, he was alive pretty recently, so
no, he only passed away a couple of years
right.
ago.
Right. So it's strange that there's really not much comment on it. I think that he's one of those filmmakers that, you know, his influence is sort of just taken for granted and not really discussed anymore, because it's more fun to talk about Steven Spielberg influencing Tony Scott or whatever and that sort of thing. And so I think yeah, like you said, I mean, lots of people have done things similar to this, but it's, yeah, it's not, I didn't really, I got creeped out by it, but not because it was a ghost story so much. I mean, Like I said, it was some guy going nuts. It was an artist going nuts. It was kind of like Pollock on, something else. It actually really reminded me of, what's that book? The Moon and Sixpence, which is about Paul Gauguin, who is the British, I don't know what he did. He was like an accountant who went crazy and ran off to the, not the Philippines. He ran off to Tahiti and became an artist and abandoned his family and, Somerset Maugham sort of fictionalized it, and there's a movie, and I haven't seen it, but it kind of reminded of that, and just that, just the insanity of the artist. I mean, that's just it's sort of a staple of,
well, cinema. You know, to try to establish a link between our good and bad movies, as we sometimes do, I'll tease the descent into madness, angle is sort of, it's sort of done as a pretension, but it's not really in the movie. And in the case of this movie, you know, because of the not establishing a base of reality type thing, Max von Sydow is just as intense at the start as he is sort of as he goes mad. I mean, like, what does he really get like that much more silent? He doesn't talk much. He's pretty stoic. He's pretty stoic in the first place. He's Max von Sydow, you know. And
it's sad what he's gone on to in sort of his American career. I mean, I just watched Judge Dredd a couple weeks ago, and you're just kind of like, and then he was in Minority Report, which was basically sort of a stylistic remake of Judge Dredd, only with Tom Cruise and a different story. But
even 12 years after Hour of the Wolf, he was in Flash Gordon. So
it was that late.
The guy just likes to work. Yeah, it is that late. I sort of assumed it was like 62, but no, it's 68.
Well, I mean, it's not. It's shot Academy ratio. It's essentially the TV, old TV. Oh, wow. We're going to have to explain that to people someday, that things weren't always shot 16:9.
Oh, I remember when
the old days
got chopped up on the television. And we'll ask what television is. Embarrassing.
Yeah. That was one of the things about this, is that Bergman's composition for, I think he always composed for 137. I know he was still doing it in the 70s. It'd be impossible to imagine this shot sort of wide. You'd lose the shots at the beginning with the boat coming to the island. It really makes you, it's one of those ones that makes you appreciate the difference between shooting for, basically the square Academy ratio and then the more rectangular scope ratios. And that was impressive really at the beginning, I think. With the boat arriving and just the way that worked. And I was thinking about how you couldn't do that in Panavision. It just, you'd have either too much or too little information. And then, the rest of it does look a lot like other Bergman movies, only with the, kind of the one setting. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wish I knew more about Bergman, because he made tons and tons of movies, I think. And so how he came across this one, which is essentially, last time we watched Yojimbo and talked about how it was sort of the start of the commercial audience movie. This reminded me, and I hate to say it, it reminded me of The Others, the Nicole Kidman. I don't know if it was a remake or whatever, but it reminded me of that. Just that sort of...
Well, that's a really similar movie, at least in story, to the Lewis Gilbert movie you're talking about. Because it's, who's really the ghost or who's really crazy or, big twist at the end. This movie doesn't have a big twist at the end, but it may as well have. I was almost expecting, the book ending interview thing to play into some kind of final shock or revelation, but it doesn't.
Yeah, instead it does this really creepy sort of questioning of sanity thing, which is nice. I mean, you don't really see... This was
more like, Bergman wouldn't have done anything else, that's what he does, is some very melancholic doom from actors.
Well, it got me thinking, they're really, it's the main character going crazy genre is, there probably isn't even one in American cinema, but
yeah,
you know, we got close with, what was that one? I mean, if Vanilla Sky had really been about Tom Cruise going nuts and killing his girlfriend, it probably would have been the greatest movie ever. Instead, it was about time travel or something. And, you know, that's how we do it here. And that's how they did it in Spain, just means that for the original Vanilla Sky, whatever it was called, that just means that they've been watching too many American movies. And this kind of compares in some ways to The Shining, where it doesn't matter.
Right.
If it's literalized as a real ghost story,
and the Shining is even less ambivalent. It, you know, it teases you with the idea that maybe Nicholson's just nuts, but then at the end it confirms that no, there really are ghosts.
And madness is forever, or whatever that whole thing was. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I watched it last night. I really liked it. I think I just can do the Bergman thing, even though
it's, yeah, his movies are kind of emotionally draining. They are not crowd pleasers, really. They're crowd squeezers or something.
Yeah, I mean, this one is just, well, I think that the other difference that you would never have an American, mainstream American movie admit that one of its main characters was kind of dumb. I think every Bergman movie I've seen kind of has some, you know, like, eh, you know, she's not very smart, you know? Hey, she's the main character, but, you know, she's not that bright. And it makes it awkward.
It's not just the, like, she's not bright. It's just that, like, these people are on another planet. Like, they seem like, you know, I keep saying they already seem nuts at the beginning, but the not brightness of the girlfriend and not just doing the horror movie thing, you know, what do people shout at the screen? Like, get out of there, right?
Right.
Like, what are you still doing there? Why are you still, you know?
Well, that was one of the problems with the beginning is when it talks about how Johan Van Sydow's painter ends up alone, and he's mysteriously alone, it doesn't make any sense that she sticks around for so long, because I kept waiting for her to leave, because they talk about it at the beginning. So it's almost like
she's even there with him during the one scene that's like the Hour of the Wolf scene, which there's even a title card in the middle of the movie.
Yeah, there is, and that
with a title card with the title of the movie. And it's really just a scene, one scene, and then the next day comes, and I'm like, that was it? That was the Hour of the Wolf? It's over. It's the next day already. But, yeah, it's a good scene. You know, it's got that person in the foreground and the background thing. And the guy's got a spooky, melancholy monologue about what the Hour of the Wolf is.
Is that when he tells her about killing the kid?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was kind of disturbing, especially when she's like, yeah, I'll stay with you. Other people
right,
would leave,
right,
but I'll stay with you.
Yeah.
I mean, the problem is, by not sort of setting up any sort of reality, they talk about going and buying food. You don't believe they go and buy food.
the budget planning scene.
You know, it's, you don't ever believe they go and buy food because it's totally nuts. People appear on this island that presumably we thought was deserted because they show up basically.
They show
up on a boat, you know? They show up on a boat to get there. You never see the boat that they take to the mainland. They don't have a boat. They arrive there with themselves. So do they take a rowboat to the mainland to get supplies?
It's implied that this guy has come here to work because it's an isolated location, and suddenly there's like a dozen people living on the island.
How did he get on the island without ever meeting his landlord was my other thing. It's never really established. I mean, the beginning mentions him being a painter and sort of a famous painter, and that's probably why I thought of the whole Gauguin thing. But it's never really clear how popular he is or whatever, because a lot of the movie revolves around his sort of obsession with a former lover. But the ghosts talk about her all the time, so it's never clear if she's... I mean, that's the big thing, is that he, at one point, he kills Liv Ullmann, as far as we know, to run off and be with his former lover, who is, well, basically visiting the ghosts, even though we aren't... It isn't... How he doesn't recognize them as the ghosts is problematic, too. Which is... You know, it's, and I'm saying this is the one of us who really liked it, is that it's not a ghost movie. It's a guy going nuts movie, which is a totally different.
Which is not necessarily a subgenre of horror.
Right. It's a totally different thing. Oh, that's a movie about a guy going nuts. Session 9. What's his name? Brad Anderson's movie.
Oh, yeah. But that's not. When you say guy going nuts movie, I kind of think of it as being very focused on just one person.
Yeah.
I mean, and I don't quite remember Session 9. It was pretty much about a group of characters.
It was about a group of characters, and the whole it being about a guy going nuts. It was also about, you know, pure evil and shit like that. So it was a bit of a cop-out. like all Brad Anderson movies. So this is. It's just. It's not. You know, I was expecting one thing, and especially when they talk at the beginning about what these creepy people look like, I was expecting the big scene, you know, like a Lynch scene, where we would have gotten to see the Birdman or whatever, and we never do. And it turns out the Birdman's just some guy who, Max von Sydow, he sees birds when he looks at him, essentially. And so as a... As a horror movie, it's lacking.
Few would be really satisfied with this as a horror movie, and yet I think that's where it gets shelved in video stores.
That's so crazy. I was what is it? The other one that Van Sydow is in, it's called Steppenwolf, and I don't know what it's about. I mean, I've never seen it. Maybe because it's only out pan and scan or something and dubbed, even on DVD, but. I thought it was about him hunting a monster. You know, it's something I read about when I was a kid. So, you know, I thought it was a werewolf movie set in East Germany or something. And maybe it is. Who knows? I haven't seen it. But that's kind of what Hour of the Wolf, the title, makes you think of, is it's going to be something uncanny. And instead it's...
Yeah.
There's nothing mysterious about this, really. It's a guy going nuts movie. Because without setting up any sort of reality to it, there's nothing else it can be. Because it just doesn't make any sense. Not make any sense in terms of narrative, but make any sense in terms of why Bergman would have made it.
Well, yeah, that's a whole other... I mean, that's something where I'm sure you'd really have to know how Bergman's career was going at this time to answer that.
Do you think he actually had commercial concerns?
No, I don't think so. So, it probably wouldn't have mattered. This was just an idea he had or something. Doesn't the plot kind of... If the plot were a little more, you know, movie-like and less stream of consciousness, doesn't it kind of remind you of The Howling? It's like a couple goes to a location to get away and to, you know, whatever, and there's a group of people on this location who are threatening to take... them to their fold. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I see that, and I mean,
it's just sort of another. It's another way that, you know, it's similar to a horror movie, but
if we could,
not really.
If we could remake it as a straightforward,
it would be very easy to remake this as a more, you know, horror-oriented movie. It's sort of like all the pieces are in place, but that's not how they were assembled.
Yeah, and it'd be interesting to know who's seen it and what they think of it. Because, you know, like I said, nobody really talks about Bergman except Woody Allen. And he only talks about
it. He'll be dead soon.
And he only talks about him in terms of, this is one of my Bergmans or whatever. He just says about, was it September and Interiors. And so, because, I mean, John Sayles, for instance, who wrote The Howling, this seems like something he would have seen, because Sayles is very, you know, he's
classy, sophisticated guy.
He's a smarty pants. this is a movie for smarty pants.
The scene when they're at the guy at the party at the castle, and the guy says, "Hey, let's watch a puppet show," and then you have that puppet show effect, which kind of looks like they you know, the guy's like, okay, now the puppet show is starting, and then they do a camera trick to make it look like it's panning down to the stage, but what you're actually looking at is a big stage, and then, like, as a figure comes out, you slowly realize that it's a human actor, you know, shot from however many feet away to look really small.
Yeah, that was creepy. Yeah. I mean, it's that kind of thing that's creepy in it, is that it's, you know, it's that was really disturbing because, and then did you notice the lighting effect to make it appear that the guy was smiling demonically with the shadows? Yeah, I mean, it's just a creepy, unpleasant time for Swedish people. That sums up a Bergman movie. There's no happiness in this movie whatsoever. Yeah. There's not a single moment in this movie when anyone is ever happy with another human being.
So true. The happiest people in the movie are like the crew that you hear setting up during the opening credits.
Yeah, and everybody else is miserable. And
well, you know what? Speaking of happiness, the ghosts who torment this couple, they're sort of mockingly happy. And they're sort of, like, mockingly cheerful and like, yes, let's have this get-together. And, you know, it's the guy who walks with the glasses who's pestering Max von Sydow and drives him to punch him down. It's like, you know, he's being too happy and, you know, it's like whatever. It's like Bill Murray and that guy he punches out in Groundhog Day. And it's something about this tortured artist who, I don't know, who's kind of like so alienated that these ghosts are almost playing on that. There's that scene where he's talking about how he, you know, sometimes when his ego is getting out of control as an artist, he reminds himself that like art is meaningless or something like that in the real world. And then everybody like applauds him and says like, "Yes, what a profound statement!" And it's very mocking. So,
well, and then that's the other thing about whether or not they have to all be ghosts just because they couldn't not be.
They're too nutty otherwise.
Well, there's also the whole problem with the sort of it working in any sort of a narrative way that, you know, what's a good example of that? You can try to, I remember when I saw Mulholland Drive, somebody was like, well, I haven't figured out how she ended up in the bed or whatever, but, and we're sitting there going, well, she couldn't have, because that's not how it works. And it's kind of like that it can't work if they're alive, because they would have known their landlords. Who rented them, if it's an inhabited island, who rented them the cottage they're staying in, that sort of thing, when you stop thinking about it. So
and the old lady says that she's 147. I mean, they don't leave you without any hints whatsoever.
It's just I think I lost, you were talking about that guy. The ghosts presumably sit around and make each other miserable is sort of what's suggested at the dinner party, is that they make each other miserable. There's, I guess you'd call him the nicest ghost, because he doesn't ever strike Van Sydow. He lost the family fortune, and so he sits around and makes fun of his brother for being poor and then cries about losing his brother's money and that sort of thing. And it's just sort of implied that they sit around and make each other miserable. But there's no, you know, for a ghost, ghost story never to explain how the ghosts became ghosts. That's kind of interesting, and they're way too contemporary to have like died 150 years ago, because they know all about his art, and so it's never explained, which calling it a ghost story is not, it's, I think it's probably because it's easier to call something a ghost story than it is to call it a guy going nuts story, because you know, we don't do those. You wouldn't watch that. You know,
when we do, it's usually about someone going crazy and in tangible circumstances. It's not about seeing the world from a crazy person's point of view for 90 minutes.
Which, you know, Van
Sydow, if we do, we're looking at it externally.
So, yeah, I don't know.
You know,
I mean,
like Falling Down or something classy like that.
Yeah, something classy like from one of the stars of Car 54. Where Are You? Let's not forget. Ebby Rose Smith.
Wow.
Yeah, that's like his other biggest credit. He starred in Car 54, Where Are You? He might have written it too. I don't know. Yeah, I really hate Falling Down. Anyway, so yeah, it's it wasn't what I was expecting at all, but you know, I was pleased that we had.
Yeah,
had
still been. Still worthwhile. It's got the Bergman seal of approval and the not really a Bergman seal of, you know, it's got its moments. So good movie.
And now to talk about something that is not a good movie.
Oh, well, you
and
know,
anyway.
Where to begin? You know, I recommended this one because I still remember it to this day, having seen it when I was 13. And when I saw it when I was 13, I was reminded of it because I read your article on Stop Button about the death of VHS and the little VHS details, like when there were double VHS sets. And I think Caligula was...
Oh,
although,
sure.
When I saw it, because it's, 2.5 hours at least. When I saw it, though, the first time I saw the R-rated cut, so, definitely they didn't show any intercourse. And I remember I was disappointed at the time because, whatever, I was, going through a video gore hound phase, and I was like, come on, man, where's the goods? You know, now I have to rent this now I have to rent this movie again and sit through all this shitty plot to see... what everybody's talking about, where this movie has an infamous reputation. And it's almost like to watch the R-rated cut again now, because we watched the unrated cut, and I feel like there's half of a good movie somewhere buried in there if you cut out all the sex, possibly.
And recast it and do all sorts of... and hire a real director and don't shoot it on... That's the thing I love about how the big deal everybody makes.
And if Bob Guccione hadn't shut the director out of the editing room,
and if the
while he was inserting all that hardcore stuff,
and if the director and writer hadn't gotten into a pissing match before principal photography even started, who knows how it might have turned out?
More than watching the R-rated cut, I want to rent the Imperial Edition DVD and find out all about the behind the scenes stuff, because the behind the scenes story behind Disasters are quite entertaining. And this one just has some big egos that went into the making of such an infamous bomb. I mean, Malcolm McDowell, who was really hot at the time, Helen Mirren and Peter O'Toole, these kind of established actors lending credibility.
I think it might have been Helen Mirren's first movie, or one of them, because was it 79?
Yeah,
she started getting big. She was a name in the early 80s as and Helen Mirren as. So yeah, I was shocked. I wasn't shocked that. I was shocked that she worked again. I mean, it's that bad that. the girl who plays the sister in this, she never really worked again.
Well, thank God.
And it's just like, I can't believe that Peter O'Toole worked again after this. John Gielgud at least had the good sense to die really, really early on, and really quickly. And it's just like, I was reading that O'Toole says he had no idea they were shooting these, hardcore pornography scenes. I'm like, what did you gave a tour of them. In one of your scenes.
Did you read? And did you, read what the director's credits were prior to this? Like, Salon Kitty, Just pure Euro sexploitation?
And so it's just like, everybody played a...
Did you not see Bob Guccione's name anywhere on the call sheet?
No, because it's that scene at the beginning where... And the other thing is, it's really stagey. And that's why it's so boring. It's written like a play, because it all has these huge ornate sets.
Yeah.
That are all like the only exterior shot I can really remember. I'm sure the street scene, which might have been when the movie was at its best, when Malcolm McDowell was that after his sister dies, he runs to the streets to see what common people think of him or something. That might arguably be the best scene, just because there was no sex in it.
Well, the best scenes are the scenes with no sex in them. the scenes with sex make you want to vomit. They're the like most unerotic stuff you've ever seen.
And then the hardcore pornography that Guccione shot for it, you feel really bad because there was a lawsuit by the woman who's in both the scenes, I guess, that he shot for it. And it's I guess he told her she'd have a speaking part if she did hardcore scenes in it or something. It's just like, you'd think she would have looked around and been like, nobody else is doing these scenes except me. Wait a second. Yeah, it's... Well, no, because there's...
How come no other cast is here except for the girl I'm supposed to eat out?
And, yeah, no, it's just... I thought those scenes... it's... At that point, your brain is so dead. I mean, really? Because they come so late.
Your brain definitely kind of, my brain at least, gives up at the end of, you know, this. When you would have had to go to the second VHS tape, like, at the end of Act 1 for all, end of Part 1 for all intents and purposes, like, when he's at the top of the world. It's just like Scarface, you know. You turn over to the second VHS when he's at the top of his empire, and then the second tape is the downfall.
And yeah, one of the things that I was curious about, and I forgot to look it up, is was Claudius really a moron? Because keeping with
Claudius, it reminded me of Glenn Shadix. Didn't he? Like Otho from Beetlejuice. He has that kind of portly, simpering, weaselly presence.
Now, I'm not
they,
that...
If they remake it, you know, like that fake trailer or whatever for the remake of... The all-female remake of Caligula, fake trailer that had famous actresses in
really?
It.
Really? I'd never heard of that.
And Helen Mirren doing a cameo. I don't think it's available to the public, but, you know.
Somebody did it once? Oh, jeez.
I'll check YouTube right now while we're talking.
But, yeah, so, you know, the end of it's really problematic because no matter how bad Caligula is presented in the movie, he's never as bad as Peter O'Toole is presented at the beginning. But then the... You know, guys who take over from Caligula.
Well, he would have gotten that way if he had lived that long. Okay, I guess is what's supposed to be implied.
Okay. Well, why didn't they kill Peter O'Toole? Would be my question.
I think it's sort of the luck of the draw. it's kind of the decadence of Rome thing, which is one of the movie's better points that I'll defend. No, I'll just defend it now. so far as Gore Vidal set out to recreate the decadence of Rome and use it for satirical purposes in a kind of broad sense of politics and, you know, the perversity that can come with power, you know, the perversity that comes with power and privilege, the banal decadence of the powerful in politics, and the cyclical nature too of, you know, tyrants, being, you know, given the keys to the kingdom at an early age and then bloodily disposed of, and then it all begins anew. That stuff is sort of well sketched out, and it's the most heavy when Peter Toole is still alive, like in the first half an hour or so of the movie.
I thought that was an hour.
Okay, 45 minutes, okay. I think, is where Peter Toole gets iced. Aside from the bizarre scene where he's leading him around his sex torture, you know, clubhouse, I think the script is pretty witty and there's some good lines and it's sort of like a real movie. it tricks you for a little while into being, you know, like it's going to be a real movie, but once Peter O'Toole is gone, yeah, shortly thereafter. Anyways, I did like, you know. I suppose, you know, if you had cut out, you know, all the sex, that you, it would have been more of a movie, maybe a 90-minute movie with some good, satire from the author.
I think some of the problem with that is going to be that, you know, if that's what Gore Vidal set out to do and got money from penthouse to do this because nobody else would give him money for this. And I think by hiring Tinto Brass, that sort of fell to the wayside because...
guy whose directorial trademark is the last three letters of his name. He likes butts.
It's, and apparently Brass actually tried to show, what is it? He tried to show ugly women as the senator's wives or something, and that's why Guccione got so upset. Whereas even, you know, as unpleasant as that scene would have been, visually it would have been more humorous than Caligula turns the... I mean, because it's...
And it wouldn't have been... It's only a problem if you want to have an orgy and show hardcore sex during that scene, which is what Guccione wanted from that scene. So they had to be hot.
Right, but if you just wanted to show... If you wanted to get the point of what Vidal was doing and what Caligula was even doing with that, you would have actually had it be, you know, realistic and have the women be these sort of
hags.
Yeah. And it's impossible to watch it and not see the influences of, you know, Vidal making commentary about stuff, like you said. And I mean, it's interesting and you can see it kind of working, but then, you know, when I think about it, it really can't because there's no audience for that, really.
Well, the movie, like, almost... Well, boy, the movie's audience is supposed to be, gosh, I mean, people who would watch porno movies anyway.
But that's from Guccione's point of view. That wasn't
from Guccione's. Yeah. That's from Guccione's point of view. And it's sort of like, was the genesis of this movie really that, like, Vidal was suckered into thinking that a pornographer could produce his movie and he would still get, like, a real movie out of it? Because what it is like a real movie that's ultimately killed by, you know, having to be a porno, like,
right?
By definition, and when it becomes a porno, it's just like, I'm watching a porno now. This is stupid.
Yeah. And then it's a gross porno, so it's
a really gross porno too. Yeah. Right? It's like, how are you supposed to pop one, like, when the last scene was people getting stakes driven into their vaginas or whatever? Because they've got this horrible violence happening intermittently with the sex, so you can't get really turned on by anything. It's even subverting you. The part of it that wants to be a real movie, I guess you could say, is sort of subverts the sexuality, and that includes the violence. Because I think if this movie had been a real movie, it still, you know, it could have probably should have included the gratuitous violence to prove the point about, you know, the decadence.
Yeah.
But coupled with the sex, it's so ludicrously unpleasant.
Well, I've heard, one of the things I read was that, what did they say? That, you know, they compared it to the other sort of decadence movies, and for some reason they used Satyricon, which I don't remember being anywhere near this, and then they said that, you know, Salo had a point. This just doesn't have a point, you know. It's just
yeah. It's like, is the point supposed to be the opening quotation from the Bible about, or not the Bible, but, you know, what profiteth a man if he lose his whole soul? This guy didn't have a soul to begin with. He was just this snotty, psychotic prince who got to have everything he wanted and was killed after a few short years.
In some ways, and this will probably be my biggest compliment to it, and I'm not sure if that's what they intended, it reads like an attempt to ape Shakespeare in a lot of ways. And I don't know if Vidal was trying to do that.
Yeah, yeah. No, I got that vibe too, especially, yeah, you know, with all these English actors right at the start of the movie.
And just the way it's set up, very stagey, long scenes, and it just very much feels like that, and that really doesn't work in some ways for making it cinematic in some ways, because Tinto Brass probably didn't get that. No offense to him. And even if he had, what was he going to do with it? He was, you know, shooting it on big, nasty sets that it's like nobody would want to live in this. This wasn't a golden age of Rome. You wouldn't want to live here. This was awful. Yeah, it was hideous.
Well, no, that's the point. It's like, you know, Christ has been born. It's pagan Rome, as the opening title tells us. It's we're in the decline as embodied by Caligula. It's one of the lines I liked is when, you know, Tiberius is kind of looking him over and, okay, those scenes are good. I really like those because it's this very layered power struggle, you know, as happened during Imperial Rome, and there's a lot going on under the surface, and, you know, it's good actors. My point was Tiberius, like, kind of, you know, he knows that this guy's going to be crazy, and when he takes the reins, he's going to run the place into the ground. So he, like, pats him on the cheek, and he says, "Yeah, yes, I'm nursing a viper in Rome's bosom." Well, it's florid, it's eloquent, and there are lines like that, but they're gone pretty quickly.
Well, there was one more line like that with what was it when he tells Helen Mirren, however he says it, when he's going to get her. He'll have to come up with a special price for her at the orgy of the the senator's wife, or the prostituting of the senator's wives. Cool. It's just...
Okay, hey, wait a minute.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's talk about the elephant in the room, Malcolm McDowell. And let me say, no. I think I might surprise you here. I have not really ever been a fan of A Clockwork Orange.
Okay.
I know it is a good movie, but it's very low on my Kubrick list. And my big problem with it is that is what the Anthony Burgess's problem with it was. I think it subverted the original idea, and it made it nihilistic, and it made it a celebration of violence, I think he said, It killed the satire. It made it too. It glamorized Alex too much. Okay, but for Malcolm McDowell, it's the performance with which he'll always be associated, and it's one of the great all time crazy guy performances. He's got a wild pair of eyes, you know, and he does a lot of horrible things in that movie, and it's very memorable. And he's very funny too, and he's, you know, that's why it's so memorable and such a classic performance. I think if I need a Malcolm McDowell fix, I would turn to Caligula, as long as I had, you know, the DVD remote handy, because this is also a really great over the top. Actually, unlike Clockwork Orange, it's over the top. It's like watching Jack Nicholson play the Joker or something. He's just, you know, chewing the scenery like, you know, like he's starving to death, and he's got. He gets off some good lines every now and then while he's being this, you know, deliciously evil. He's like Vincent Price in some of those Corman Poe movies, like Mask of the Red Death, where he's just this cruel, where Vincent Price is this decadent prince living in a castle who, you know, sets people on fire for laughs.
Now, okay, so I'm not a Malcolm McDowell fan. At all.
Me either. But I mean, you know, so far as his merits as an actor, they're pretty well exploited here, I think.
Well, yeah, I think that. See, didn't he? He's always creepy, is
right.
The thing. And so, even when you see him in what was that one called? The Time After Time, where he plays the traditional hero. It's sort of creepy because it's still Malcolm McDowell. And at least at this point in his career, I can see that he had not become, as he sort of later did, pretty quickly, really, I think by Cat People, he became, I don't know, probably on the acting level of Victor Mature. I mean, he was just awful. Sort of as I grew up and seeing Malcolm McDowell in movies, I was like, oh God, another Malcolm McDowell movie. And so seeing him in something like this where, yeah, he's, but the problem is Brass doesn't sort of realize that he has this great villain to luxuriate in, I guess. And that's the difference between it and the Joker, or it and even Joe Pesci in Casino, which is, you know, Pesci, you know, brutalizing everyone around him. But it's played for laughs, and, you know, it's probably Scorsese making some comment about, you know, how we laugh at awful things or whatever, but whatever. It's, Brass doesn't get it, and you kind of feel like all they went for a really big director. They went for John Huston. He said no, but I find it hard to believe they couldn't get somebody else to do this.
It's a big scale between Brass and Huston.
Right. Yeah. You're kind of, you know...
unless it was like, we can't get Huston, now fuck it, let's just get a titty director.
Yeah, and did they just give up? I mean, did they give up trying to direct, to do this? And yeah, so it's, what did Malcolm McDowell say, that he did this movie because at the time when somebody asked you to do a Gore Vidal script, you said yes or something?
Yeah, although, yeah, looking at Gore Vidal's resume,
he just made terrible movies.
Yeah, he made some really terrible movies.
Yeah. That's the funniest thing is, you know, I think Malcolm McDowell, speaking of Gore Vidal as a sort of cultural figure versus screenwriter, or I hope he is anyway.
Yeah, being a good novelist doesn't necessarily translate to the silver screen.
Yeah, so it's of course the movie is only based upon the screenplay written by Gore Vidal.
As mentioned in the opening credits, based upon the screenplay.
And it's, what is it, editing room directed by or something? There's some other odd credit.
Additional scenes directed.
Yeah, it's this it's is like
it's the Superman of sexploitation.
Except Superman couldn't mention it because, you know, the DGA, or because Donner was a DGA director, but
yeah.
So this is, okay, well, we really haven't gone through it. Okay, so you have Peter O'Toole at the beginning, and Peter O'Toole's face is falling apart, and Malcolm McDowell has a beard.
Oh, yeah. Do you want to explain this?
The disappearing beard? I can't, because I thought it was a flashback, and I'm like, wait, wasn't John Gielgud just alive? Why is he dying now? Because Malcolm McDowell's younger, because they aren't bickering as much, and
that's all Guccione's influence. you could call it. It's all Guccione's inspiration.
I never did get around to talking about the ending. Okay, so as bad as Caligula is supposed to be, and I mean he's really bad. He does the Braveheart, what is it, first night thing. And then does it to the husband, too. I mean, he's just a jerk. And then he kills the husband later on because he gets the wife pregnant or whatever. He's just a real jerk. They manage to make him a sympathetic character at the end by making everyone else worse. You're watching the end, and they kill him, and it's this really bad... you know they were going for something that they'd seen in some other movie. Maybe even... I'm thinking about the pacing and...
Well, it's sort of, you know, it's almost like a gangster movie by the end where, you know, the guy has to have his comeuppance in a spectacular way.
But that scene is so foreshadowed. How did he not think something was going to happen? It's just forever and ever and ever.
You almost expect the character himself of Caligula to say, hey, there's a lot of foreshadowing going on around here.
If Caligula broke the third wall or fourth wall, it would be great. It would actually be...
It would redeem everything.
Everything. They could do anything. And in fact, they ought to do it now while Malcolm McDowell's still alive, and they ought to do like a video game Caligula who turns his head to you and he's like, I'm a bastard! Or like he can stick
his... Ain't I a stinker?
That's perfect. And like they can insert a shot where he watches the hardcore lesbian scene, because then there'd be a point for it in the movie, because it's... otherwise supposed to be the two girls getting turned on by Caligula having a threesome with him and his wife or something. Mm-hmm. And you're just kind of like,
it's foreshadowing, you know, more tits later.
So, but then the end, He gets killed. His wife gets killed. And you're like, oh, that's terrible. They killed his wife.
In lavish slow motion, he, his wife, and his young daughter get
they
killed.
They take the kid and slam the kid.
And, or they slam a really bad-looking dummy.
I do like the horrified insert of the maid, though. I mean, that was just like, holy shit. Because it's clear she knew they were going to kill Caligula and the wife. But no, they're going to kill the kid, too. And I mean, that really happened. They really did slam
it. Oh, hey, there's another commonality between our two movies.
What?
Dead kid.
Dead kid? Dead kid. Gee. Oh, wow. What if Caligula had killed the kid like they killed the kid in Hour of the Wolf? That would have been amazing. Well,
yeah, I guess. You would have bought it, certainly. Sorry.
The bad guy who kills the kid is some big... Oh, we got to talk about his sidekick at the end, too. He looks like a barbarian out of a bad guy out of. He looks like the bad guy in People That Time Forgot, who was on the video box cover.
You're talking about Longinus?
No, not that guy. The guy who actually kills the kid, who takes it from the nurse and slams her against the.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, Longinus with the thing on his forehead. Yeah, that was.
Richard O'Brien.
That was Dune type thing. But I guess that's how they really killed the daughter, who wouldn't have been in line for the throne anyway, because it was a daughter.
Except he had declared her a son.
They could have probably fixed that. But yeah, so it makes everyone more brutal than Malcolm McDowell ever was, because he never killed a kid, and it just, you know.
He never killed anyone with his bare hands. Wait a minute. That's not true.
Yeah. But still, I mean, it just makes everybody else so much worse than Caligula ever was. And you know,
you know what? That is almost like at the end of Scarface, where you feel a little bad for Tony. What? Romano? What the fuck is it?
I didn't feel bad for Tony.
Tony Montana. Okay. You don't really feel bad. But look, I didn't feel bad for Caligula, too, but I'm trying to run with this. it's like he's in a gunfight with. With a small army, you know, they just keep coming, and it's absurd. So it's sort of, you know, part of you wants to see if he can, to see if he can make it, because it's such ridiculous odds against him.
In Caligula, there wasn't any real chance of that, but I think when they kill the kid, it just sort of, you know, it just gets so much. They get so much worse. But then, yeah, the sidekick. We got to talk. I want to talk about the sidekick.
Okay.
Because Caligula goes out on the street and he ends up in jail and what does he do? A coin trick that endears him?
He does a magic trick, yeah.
Yeah. And so.
And the jailer, they exchange magic tricks and then the jailer sees his imperial ring, recognizes him, cut to Caligula has brought him back to his pad and. He smells, but pretty soon he's wearing nice clothes, and he's not really a character after that, but you always see him hanging around, like, you know, partying with Caligula.
Yeah, it becomes like this weird buddy movie where he's like, yeah.
But not really, because they ignore that. He doesn't really become any more of a character after that, and it's a missed opportunity.
Well, it is a missed opportunity, but can you imagine how much, you know, fun they would have with the recut with the CGI Malcolm McDowell? And they could have that guy in there, and they could have, John Favreau play him or some lame big guy, whoever the big guy is right now. So it's just, it's really traditional in a way that.
Parts of it are, yeah.
Yeah, and it's strange that they don't sort of.
The way it alternates between a real movie and a porno ruins. Really ruins the parts of it that are like a real movie.
Yeah.
Because you're still in shock. Because you're still in shock from the last thing of like, what the fuck was that? why were they playing like, you know, clanging pots and pans and shit over a orgy that's, you know, cut like, you know, where there's a cut every 2 seconds.
Yeah, this one, you know, like I said, blame me for picking this. My influence. You did. You said it came to you following reading my.
But it's not blame. I actually, and this is one of my favorite bad movies.
really, because it's just so unpleasant.
There's so much to talk about.
Well, there's ton. I mean, we could talk about this for another 2 hours, probably. Uh-huh. I mean, but it's just such an unpleasant viewing experience.
It really is.
It's,
yeah.
You know,
I think I could wait another 10 years.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, people are like, oh yeah, Caligula. I've never seen that. I really wanted to, and you're just kind of like, what? You did? Okay. Have you really seen any of it? Because. Like, whenever anybody's like, I've seen this, I'm like, why did you watch it? I had a good reason for watching it as an adult. I mean, you know, I can understand. You watched it when you were 13, you know, whatever. Right. That's one thing. But as an adult watching it, no. People aren't lying about it.
Fans, well, you know what? Exploitation fans, too. I mean, fans of movies like Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS. And
yeah, I mean, you could see that.
I Spit on Your Grave. It is part of that circle of movies. But even amongst, I think it's sort of been forgotten even by exploitation, you know, bizarre movie fans, too. Its infamy has kind of waned over the years.
And I think some of that's just because the cast... I'm sure at the time it was a big deal when Malcolm McDowell went on to do something else and whatever, but yeah, no, I mean, at this point, Malcolm McDowell was, I mean, I don't know if he was ever in a Disney movie, but he might as well have been. I mean, you know, it feels like that. It's not infamous anymore, and it truly is. I mean, it actually does deserve
a
lot
really,
of that.
Well, like you said, it's odd that it didn't really kill anyone's careers, not even Tinto Brass. Tinto.
Well, no, he never did anything that had a major theatrical release.
Oh, yeah, except for that, right.
Except for, you know, the whole really working thing. And, I mean, you know, he probably enjoyed whatever his career that he enjoyed. He probably preferred it to... Well, no, I'm sure he didn't prefer it to making money, but, you know, come on. But no, I mean, like, Peter O'Toole, come on. At the time, he's like, I had no idea it was pornographic. And you're like, Peter, what, when you were pointing to the people having sex, what did you think they were doing? Because you were there, right? Like,
yeah,
your
when
makeup.
You're in that pool full of naked people.
Yeah, and what did you
it's
think?
Weird. It's weird, the proposition that he seems to be making that... he would have been comfortable in a movie with ridiculous amounts of nudity so long as there wasn't any actual intercourse, because it's not really any classier.
And I mean, let's see. Malcolm McDowell sort of, at least until what, the Star Trek movie, I guess. I mean, that's his most mainstream role, right? Mm-hmm. He was the bad guy in Star Trek VII. Who kills Kirk or whatever. And
well, actually, no. His most mainstream role is now Dr. Loomis in Halloween.
Oh, that's right. And you would think they would somehow interact with the fact that they were casting Malcolm McDowell in this. But, I mean, Helen Mirren went on to become, you know... played the Queen of England. I'm sitting there watching going, yeah.
She played the Queen of England, and she's getting simulated butt-fucking from Malcolm McDowell right now.
On the other hand, she is married to the guy who produced Rooftops. So, you know, Malcolm, I'm sure she is a complicated woman.
A lady of particular tastes.
So... And then, yeah, the careers it did kill, it killed the sister's career, and it's like, why? Of all the people's careers in this that it could have killed, why hers? I mean, she was just this...
She was expendable.
And she was relatively harmless. I mean, she wasn't good, but, I mean, you know, saying she's worse than...
She sort of reminded me of the scheming wife in Yojimbo, and how you said that wife character was kind of the most evil character in the movie because she's pulling the strings. This movie doesn't address the fact that Caligula's sister is... his most influential advisor. It goes into her, you know, body and her nakedness, but no, I thought that was one of the more interesting aspects left untouched. Is that, well, actually, I mean, I guess it's sort of implied that after she dies, his empire's, you
that's
know,
when it goes
really
to crap.
Goes to
pot. Yeah, that's when it goes to pot.
But they don't really, that's not really spelled out or anything. But she was kind of the brains behind the outfit.
Yeah, I mean, when she dies, it goes to Helen Mirren's wife, who is presented as a tramp, sort of a not even a scheming tramp, but just a trampy.
Mm-hmm.
The pregnancy thing. Oh, geez. Oh, there's a scene where he won't marry Helen Mirren until she gives birth to his child. And so we have this sort of really graphic scene with her giving birth.
Right.
That's really, yeah, just...
That didn't even really stick in my memory for any particular reason. It was so superfluous.
Well, I think I'm just remembering it because it's one of those stagey scenes. I mean, it's such a stagey movie, and I think that's kind of the problem with it, is that it's not... Yeah, I don't know if Vidal's script was like that. I don't know if they were stuck with shooting on the sets they built, but it feels very stagey. It feels... And they're not interacting... The cinematography's so flat that it's not like they're trying to comment on Rome's luster failing. But the thing is that, you know, Rome was an empire, but they basically took everything good the Greeks did and then, you know, had vomitoriums, right? I mean, they're not... Yeah. It's not like we owe much to the Romans except for... language and...
Yeah, what have the Romans ever done for us?
What, government, well, right? I think some government stuff. And roads. That's... What?
Oh, I'm thinking Life of Brian. Never mind.
Oh, okay. Well, the scene where they invade England should have been awesome. It's this... It's comical, or it should be comical, and it's Caligula and his buddies sitting around, and he's commanding the army to attack these fields... And everybody's like, what the hell are you doing? He's like, that's England. I'm invading England. And it should be hilarious. And it's not.
Yeah, and it's sort of weird that they're, like, having this moment of humor so late in the movie. And I guess it's just sort of, like, more grist for, you know, his backstabbing inner circle at this point, for them to shake their heads and go, like, yeah, he's really lost it. Yeah, we're going to have to kill him.
Yeah.
Because there's nowhere else for the movie to go at that point. It's just like you're marking time until he's offed.
Which kind of makes you wonder what they originally envisioned the movie to be before. Like, okay, so Vidal got kicked out when he said something nasty about Tinto Brass, right? Mm-hmm. Tinto Brass got kicked out because he didn't cast Playmates or what are they, Penthouse Pets, as this in the orgy scenes. Okay, so what if Brass had cast Penthouse Pets? What if Vidal hadn't gotten kicked out? How, I mean,
and what if Guccione hadn't inserted hardcore?
Well, I mean, even the hardcore insertions, really. I mean, the two that everybody...
You think any of that helped the movie in any way whatsoever?
The lesbian scene was dumb.
Uh-huh.
Kind of seemed awkward in terms of, you know, where, why it was there. I mean...
Well, there was no reason whatsoever.
Well, no, not even for that, but I mean, like, for the person watching the movie, like, Pee Wee Herman watching this movie, like, he's not going to sit through an hour and a half to get to this moment.
Lord does not forgive you for that one.
Okay, and the second scene is, I think they threw that in there to be even more daring, just to be like, wow, look what we're doing, and, having recently turned off a Vincent Gallo movie, I'm kind of thinking that, you know, we haven't come that far from then, that, you know, the Brown Bunny. We still think that this is going to somehow make people take notice. And
then it's right that it's going to be something, you know, mind blowing. Like I think the trailer for this movie is Bob Guccione saying, "I'd like to take you, if I may, on a fantastic new kind of film motion picture experience." You know, we all love to be thrilled when we go to the movies. Blah, 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 blah. He's talking about this massive piece of shit and how it's going to change your life.
And it, which brings us back to it was expensive. Mm-hmm. They had a very mainstream cast. They had a respectable screenwriter. And seriously, they couldn't have thrown piles of money at, all right, so it's 78.
Monty Hellman or somebody, like somebody what, cheap but
Billy
good.
Friedkin. Billy Friedkin was probably...
Yeah.
You know, he probably... Or John Borman had just made The Exorcist 2, right? Couldn't they?
John, hey, how about John Milius?
He wasn't directing yet, was he?
Maybe. Yeah, I think he was. I think Big Wednesday had come out before.
Okay, yeah. I mean, yeah. Any of these guys. Come on! You know, and it's just like... Yeah. And or here's a crazy idea. A good Italian filmmaker... I mean, there are other good Italian filmmakers. I mean, it's not like Fellini's got a, you know, he's the only one.
They don't have to be the director of Salon Kitty to have worked with lots of nudity either. They're Italian. They naked breasts in their movies, you know, even if it's a children's film.
Because if we're talking about this in terms of, you know, Guccione's perspective, he wanted it to make money. Right. And so why wouldn't he have tried to, I mean...
I think because, you know, he produced this movie himself, if you know what I mean. Like, it didn't really need a director. The guy is like John Peters. He inserts his sex beats instead of action beats, and, you know, and that's how you make a hit movie. You have sex every so often, and you have violence every so often, and you cast the big names. You throw money at gigantic, elaborate, well-detailed sets.
Well-detailed, but gloomy and poorly lit sets.
Right, like Batman. Except good in that case. Gloomy with a purpose.
Well, no, I don't mean gloomy in terms of setting a mood. I mean gloomy in terms of poorly lit, sort
right,
of.
Right, right.
Yeah, no, because yeah. I mean... I was going to say, are you saying that Batman's poorly lit? Because I don't think that it is. It's not.
It's
not as vibrantly lit as Returns, but still, the first one's competently lit. This one is... Caligula is not competently lit at all.
Caligula is lit like a stage play. Like, they just... Because they showed up and they had these gigantic sound stages, I'm sure, with these huge... You know, the fucking three-story, you know, sex and torture garden that Peter O'Toole has. They probably just flooded it with light and shot it that way because they had to have that camera following him and McDowell around it. And a lot of scenes were set up that way. Had a lot of people.
Were you shocked
room.
This wasn't Panavision? Because I was shocked it wasn't Panavision.
Yeah, I was sort of. I wasn't shocked, but you know, I was trying to remember if it had been Panavision or not because it seemed like it could have been.
Well, and then it occurred to me. You know, at this period, there really weren't many alternative processes. Now there's, was it JDC Scope was a big one, I think, and then there's Super 35 and stuff like that. But that was all stuff in the 80s, as far as I can remember. So my thing is that they would have had to rent the cameras from Panavision, because, you know... Mm-hmm. Panavision's all rentals. And what, did Panavision not rent Bob Guccione cameras or something? Because, there's so many movies that are shot Panavision that shouldn't be. And every once in a while, you come across something that you're like, at least if they shot it, Panavision.
Yeah, but, they didn't need Panavision when they had gigantic sets. And I really wanted to mention the wall of death, that giant wall of death with its spinning blades. I mean,
when was that?
Oh, actually, come on.
No, I don't remember the wall of death. What was it?
This is the scene where it's pretty short, but it's this scene where Caligula's just had his nephew frame, that got Marco for the murder of Tiberius, and after he's been sentenced to death, he's buried up to the neck with a bunch of other prisoners.
Oh, that one, yeah.
Yeah, that thing was gigantic. They built like a 50-foot wall with spinning blades at the bottom and like actual people standing in this thing, and it's all like detail, it's all sculpted, and it has like columns and arches and figures in it, and it's this gigantic wall that just moves forward, and it has spinning blades at the bottom that decapitate these heads, and it's actually one of the, it's one of the moments of, you know, grand decadence that really works, partly because it's over so quickly and it's just so, it's just such a bizarre sight. It's otherworldly. I mean, sometimes this movie really does create a sense of like history as this otherworldly place, and Rome,
that
is
was,
this,
yeah.
Rome is this otherworldly place. The kind of concept dramatization of history where it's like the conception of it really acknowledges that like the civilization is so different 2,000 years ago that it's kind of unimaginable to us now.
Especially during Peter O'Toole's tour, you know, they go through the what does he call them, like living statues, right? That they're
right.
Just people having sex. And then he gets to the freak garden.
Mm-hmm.
And all I could think during that was, so they hunted the Empire for freaks to bring to Peter O'Toole's. And it's not, I'm sure they cast some people with disfigurements and stuff like that.
Yeah, it was a mix.
But then there's the woman with two faces and another eye or something, and you're just like, oh, well, come on.
Come on.
So that's like Star Wars, man.
But I was less shocked by the crappy sub Star Wars makeup effects in that same little moment than their casting of people with actual deformities, because that's like, that's crossing that, you know, Todd Browning line that I thought hadn't been crossed since Freaks.
No, because what's that movie called? I can't remember who's in it. It's not called The Gate. It's from like 78, 79. Jennifer O'Neill might be in it from Scanners. It's about some woman who finds out her apartment building is, you know, the crossroads to hell or something. And they did the same thing. And they got busted for it because it was, you know, a domestic production, whereas Guccione, I'm sure,
taking advantage like a good producer.
Yeah, he was just it's like ooey bowl,
sparing no expense,
yeah.
You could say.
So I mean, that maybe that's who ought to remake Caligula. Ooey bowl.
Nah.
No, because he'd get Michael Madsen to play Caligula, and it'd just be boring and awful. It'd be so bad. And Caligula is boring. I mean, that's the other thing, is it's so boring. And I'm sure Vidal has or had some sort of theory of Caligula as the anti-historical epic. You know, because it does not...
Right, it's like, it's not about a great man. It's about the opposite.
Right, it's not like, this isn't Spartacus or something, the Spartacus approach to how we present Roman stuff.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the anti that. It's this postmodern look at it. And the truth is, it's not interesting to watch, is the problem.
No.
But the thing that occurred to me was, I, Claudius, that famous miniseries, is that about the same Claudius who's in this one?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay, so in that one, is he supposed to be an idiot in that one, too?
Well, I don't know. I never saw it.
Yeah, I mean, that's my big thing, is like, because 12 episodes of Derek Jacobi playing a twit would be, like, it'd be funny. I mean...
Hey, am I crazy, or... there's that awesome, like, oh shit moment where Claudius, you know, his wife, Caligula's sister is sick, and Claudius says, you know, to be a suck up, he says, I would offer my life to Jupiter, you know, if it meant that she would, Caligula is sick. And he says, oh, I would offer my life to Jupiter in exchange for yours, and he smirks, and he's like, all right, fine, take him away, you know. But, and then doesn't he show up again after that? I mean...
Yeah.
Was he murdered off screen and came back? Okay, I didn't imagine that.
He wasn't paying enough attention. No, I guess he just wasn't murdered.
Right,
you know,
but it's so...
The other big structural breaking point is one that I read about later, is that when they announced start of principal photography, whatever that line he has... I am God or whatever. Mm-hmm. Originally it says, I have a wife, I have a husband, I am a God or something. And they at some point totally cut all the homosexual stuff except that one kiss between him and the guy he soon betrays. And, I mean, Peter O'Toole, certainly it's implied that he likes oysters and thing.
Yeah, to put it in Spartacus terms.
Yeah, to put it in Spartacus terms. But then there's the whole thing about Caligula coming on to his cousin, and that's never goes anywhere. And
right, so pieces of it remain. And, you know, the funny thing about, I mean, it was McDowell's idea to have Caligula fist proctologist, I mean Proculus, instead of raping him like his wife. How is that any less homo exact, and how is that any less worse? It would have been so much less worse if he had just anally violated him than if he, because that's one of the things that you'd remember from the movie, because it's so brutally set up and staged and followed through, the simulated anal fisting by Malcolm McDowell of Proculus.
Yeah.
So
gross.
I didn't
know that was his idea.
Yeah. He refused to do the simulated butt sex.
Really?
Yep.
Because the other was so less gay?
Yeah. Makes no sense. Okay. Maybe it's an English thing. Maybe they do that at their boring schools, so it's considered more commonplace. Am I really down on the English or something? I just realized. I'm kind of always ragging on them.
But what if that's true? Because that almost like sounds reasonable. Like somebody's like, "Oh yeah, they do it all the time." And that's how they punish the guys. It's instead of the bag of soap.
They're always playing bum games over there. Anywho.
Yeah, okay, so we've covered that. We've covered... is the music any good? I can't remember. Music's kind of okay, isn't it?
I do like their use of Prokofiev, you know, the classical music. Again, classy touches. I like the title music, which I believe is a classical piece. They have a nice piece of music that they keep using over and over, which is like the love theme to Caligula, practically. The music's not the worst part of the movie, you could say, if you wanted to be complimentary.
Is it as bad as the music in, is it as good as the music in Bad Magic, though? It's probably better. Well, there you go. Yeah. So...
We're
never going to be able to top Caligula as a bad movie, though. Because, I mean, it tops Bad Magic, because it's twice as long, and Guccione did not have the cojones to cast men in drag as the women in Caligula, as they did in Bad Magic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think we're ever going to be able to top... Because it's one of those famous ones, too, is that it's, you know...
Yeah, the famous flops.
I don't think there's anybody who likes Caligula. Are there any critics that...
Well, I don't know if... you know what? I was about to make a silly case that fans put out the Imperial Edition, but... It's Bob Guccione. He can put out a fucking 10-disc set of Caligula if he wants.
Oh, I thought it was in the public domain. And Lionsgate picked it up.
Oh, my God, no. How could anything owned by Penthouse end up in the public domain? They'll keep milking it for as long as they can.
Okay, so can you buy the Imperial Edition in stores?
Probably, because nobody else is going to. Yeah,
you know, like does Best Buy?
Yeah,
know?
Yes. It's like enough of a real movie. Yeah,
it is. Can I buy the brown bunny?
It's got Helen Mirren in it.
But can I buy the brown bunny at Best Buy?
I don't know.
Because I couldn't rent Last Temptation of Christ at Blockbuster, so you know, and
Blockbuster is another story again.
Yeah, so, I mean, Caligula, I guess, like, Bad Magic should be watched in a group without any seriousness. Intoxicated, if possible.
But I think it's required viewing for Bad Movie Connoisseurs, and it's educational too.
learn some things about Roman history that
It's got its moments, I must say. I would be remiss to say that it's all bad. It's just 90% bad. So Caligula recommended, and I'm recommending it more enthusiastically than Hour of the Wolf. But that's just me, I guess.
Bergman is rolling in his grave, and Bob Guccione better start advertising on our show.
I'm plugging the DVD. I'm saying the making of this movie must be fascinating.
But is it a good document? I mean, because so many DVD making of documentaries are crap. I mean, it would be interesting if it was a good one, I suppose.
Well, it's probably, you know, actually all DVD documentaries are propaganda for the movie that you bought. So this will be the documentaries on Caligula. Probably won't go into the breakups internally too much.
I thought that Warner Brothers sort of broke that mold with the Batman, the first four, and the Superman documentaries, that they were, because they had relaunched them under different producers, they were able to shit-mouth the experiences.
I don't think they did too much. I mean, not if you know what Tim Burton has said about the experiences elsewhere. He kind of hints at it. Actually, I would disagree with that, because the Batman DVD, the feature-length documentary on the Batman DVD, is one of my favorites because it features so much John Peters saying gems like, you know, the screenplay for a movie is not the Bible. It's the blueprint, you know?
Well, no, because...
And I'm like, no, the blueprint is what you have to adhere to when you're making a building. A Bible is something that you interpret loosely, you know? It just, you know.
No, because Joel Schumacher takes responsibility.
Oh, that's right. But that's what you're thinking of, right?
Yeah.
Joel Schumacher.
Burton didn't do new interviews for the Batmans, did he?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
Oh, okay.
Michael Keaton didn't, which was interesting. Neither did Pfeiffer. But DeVito and Nicholson did, which was interesting.
That is very interesting. Anyway, yeah. So next time...
Next week, we're going to dip back into the Oliver Stone well with his second movie that he ever directed. It was a horror movie, probably a lot more of a direct horror movie than Hour of the Wolf, but it is about a guy kind of losing it. In fact, he loses an appendage. Michael Caine is in The Hand, and it's not even... I know before even watching this, I know it's... I've got another Crawling Hand movie to compare it to. The Crawling Hand from the 50s, as featured on MST3K.
Now, footage from The Hand was used in something, and I don't know what, but I was aware of the movie before I ever knew that it was... I mean, I was aware of a Michael Caine movie where Michael Caine's hand was after him before I ever knew what the movie was. And I can't remember what it was. I mean, it was just clips of it, like, you know, maybe it was Muppet Babies. I have absolutely no idea what this was, but at some point in the late 80s, they used clips from The Hand and something else.
Maybe it's the, you know what, here's what I remember from however many years ago when I saw, like, probably 2 minutes of this on television, is kind of like a hand cam thing of a... A camera, you know, a camera scurrying along the floor of a room or through the grass or something.
What year is The Hand? Is it 78?
No, it's 81.
Oh, okay. So Oliver Stone.
Probably would have been more at home in 78.
Okay, when was the first face hugger cam in an Alien movie?
I don't think there was until Resurrection and Joss Whedon.
Okay.
If it was him or Paul Anderson.
Okay, so...
Anyways, that's our bad movie. And our good movie is Blue Collar by Paul Schrader, who's he's a real interesting director. I mean, I'm glad we're seeing this because since autofocus kind of turned me on to him before I'd seen some of his movies that he was more well known for, and of course, you know, he's the screenwriter of Taxi Driver and stuff, so you kind of want to give all of his movies a shot. And I've heard this is one of his best ones, and besides which, it's got an amazing on paper anyway cast of Yaphet Kotto, Harvey Keitel, and Forrest Whitaker, I think.
No, Richard Pryor.
Oh, Richard Pryor, right? Yeah, so I'm really looking forward to this. For Richard Pryor, you know, alone, right?
In a dramatic role, I think his only dramatic role. Yeah, it's. I think it's. I think this is the one from 78.
It takes place in Flint, Michigan, too. and Paul Schrader's got a real Michigan thing going. I'm from Michigan, so I've been to a lot of these places. Like he said, Hardcore in Grand Rapids, I think, and he shoots on location. So I think this is probably shot on location.
Yeah, so that'll be good. And Oliver Stone's The Hand will not be good.
Right. Be sure and check out our site, alansmithypodcast.wordpress.com, for updates and trivia and past episodes. And please leave us comments on iTunes, and you can make suggestions for movies that we'll watch, and we'll take them seriously.
And I don't know, maybe we should make a link for you selling the Imperial Edition of Caligula.
Yeah, let's get that Amazon sponsorship going. Let's do some business for Bob Guccione.
Bob Guccione presented this episode, by the way, but didn't provide copies of Caligula. I'm Andrew.
I'm Matt.
Thanks for listening.
And Alan Smithy Podcast. Bye.